Thank you to everyone who's here with us again for our learning, continuing our exploration of these really interesting issues in halachic and ethical questions that arise regarding emerging developments in fertility treatment. Just by way of review, as again, as people are making their way in, so our first week we looked at issues regarding the destruction or disposal of surplus fertilized pre-embryos, right, in the process of IVF, when there are extra embryos that are produced that are left over after a family has attempted to have the number of children they wish to have. They're extra embryos. They have all the genetic material to be people, but in the meantime, they're just teeny tiny cells. Can they be disposed of? And if so, by what means? We discussed that in our first session. And last week, we talked about what happens also as part of the IVF process when what happens if the wrong embryo or pre-embryo is implanted into the wrong gestational mother, who has the rights to parenthood, and sort of the questions that brings to the fore about the halachic or Jewish or Torah perspective on parenthood. So that's what we've seen so far. And this week, our scheduled topic is artificial wombs. So questions that arise regarding this emerging technology. But maybe I'll just take a minute to address some points that came up at the end of last class. Again, as we just have the last few people coming in to the Zoom session. So just again, a few words about questions that are raised at the end. First of all, there's a question raised about the right to information about one's genetic siblings. Right, it can happen that one would share genetic material with people whom they don't know, right? If you, if someone, let's say, is an egg donor or a sperm donor and donates eggs or sperm to multiple people, then you could have these two children across the earth from each other who share a genetic parent. Or better yet, if you have, if you live in a country where there's the possibility of donating surplus pre-embryos, when one is finished with their own IVF journey, right? In the state of Israel, it's not yet allowed. But I believe in Canada it is, and a few other countries. So if that's the case, then you could even have two siblings who share all the same genetic material, right? They have the same genetic father and the same genetic mother, born to different families. Do they have some right to know whom their genetic siblings are? In the literature, these are called diblings, donor siblings. And there are all sorts of stories about people trying to find their diblings. There have been some really extreme cases that have emerged where people discovered that their own spouses were their diblings, which poses a whole host of questions. So interestingly, to date, in the U.S. and Canada and Europe, there is not a formal right, you know, anchored in law that gives diblings, donor siblings, the right to know whom their genetic parents or genetic siblings are. On the argument that, generally speaking, these donations of genetic material are meant to be done anonymously. That's part of the whole system. It's a way of protecting the donor. It's a way of, it was supposedly a way to, maintain sort of a healthier sense of whom one's parents were. I'm not going to get too confused about who's who. But there's a growing movement, pushing for the rights of genetic siblings to know about their family. People who want to just have some understanding of whom they are, where they come from. So there has been such a push for that in a number of places, the US, Canada, and elsewhere. Interestingly, Israel has a bit of a different story where Israel takes much less seriously than needs to protect the rights of donors to remain anonymous. And that's because in Israel, a lot of public policy around these sorts of issues regarding fertility treatment are highly influenced, not dictated by, but highly influenced by the rabbinate, because the rabbinate, the Israeli chief rabbinate, has authority over issues of personal status. And the Israeli chief rabbinate is very concerned about the possibility of diblings getting mixed up and accidentally marrying each other, which arguably, if we say that your genetic relationship is what determines your sibling relationship halakhically, then that's incest. So that wouldn't be good. And so the rabbinate is very concerned about such things, and therefore the state of Israel actually keeps very good records of who the diblings are out there in Israel. Now, they don't necessarily always share that information, but they have it available such that prior to marriage, in theory, one is meant to check with the rabbinate just to be 100% sure. There's no possibility that you are, unbeknownst to yourself, a sibling or otherwise relative of your spouse to be. So that information is available. But is there halachic language around the right to know? There isn't so much, and that's in large part because in Israel, it's dictated by the rabbinate, where there actually are ways more or less of finding out, at least to the degree to which it is necessary for halakhic purposes. And in other places, it's the kind of public policy issue that I think most rabbinic thinkers realize they don't really have a say on, right? It's the kind of thing that that they tend to not have too much to say about. So I was anyway, I'd come up at the end of last week's class, so I figured I'd do some research and share what I had with you. But there's a lot of interesting literature that's emerging now, sort of calling into question this notion that we should withhold information from people about their genetic family, and that in fact we should be making this information accessible, available, so people know something about who they are. So anyway, it's part of this larger picture of what do we make, how do we socially, culturally navigate our shifting perspectives on what these various forms of fertility treatment do for us as humans. Okay, so that's that issue. But I'd like to get to the issue of the day, now that I'm guessing we're all here, which is artificial wombs. Okay, artificial wombs. It sounds cool, doesn't it? Like that would be at least, I was about to say awesome. Awesome is maybe too much of a value judgment, but it would certainly be pretty extraordinary if it was possible to give birth to children without anybody having to go through pregnancy. If you could just, go to the IVF clinic, take the sperm, the egg, put them together, take that pre-embryo, put it in a machine, wait 9 months like a bread machine that comes out a baby. That would be great. There have definitely been Judith Butler and Beauvoir, like there have been various feminist thinkers that have pushed for the notion of artificial womb technology as a way of freeing women from the oppression that they've suffered as an outgrowth of the natural pregnancy. So there are certain people who push in that direction. There are also people who are very deeply, deeply disturbed by this idea, right? Aldous Huxley already writes about this in the 1930s, this sort of imagined world where the government just makes babies in factories. It's the kind of thing that would really radically change our conception of what it means to bring babies into the world if, in fact, there were artificial wombs that would allow for full ectogenesis, right? Full development or production of a baby outside of a human womb. It would be pretty crazy, right? The questions that would emerge about what happens, if, babies are made by mistake, or, who is in charge of them, who are the parents, all sorts of questions. It would be really, really exciting. But for better or for worse, basically everyone in the field says this will not exist anytime in the foreseeable future. We don't, whether one thinks that it would be the best or worst technological development known to humankind, it's not happening in the near future, maybe in the distant future, but for the time being, artificial wombs are just not built to do that. However, artificial womb technology, that's really what we should call it, AWT, artificial womb technology, is under development. And there are some questions to raise about it, primarily not regarding what is called full ectogenesis, but rather partial ectogenesis, systems that are used that can allow for some degree of development outside of a human womb. So let's look at these issues together. If you give me a moment, I'm just going to share the screen so we can see the slides together. All right, if I could just get a thumbs up if you can see the slides on your screen. Fantastic. Thank you, everybody. So again, this issue is actually quite relevant and quite real. The headlines started talking about artificial wombs in 2017 when a team at CHOP Children's Hospital of Philadelphia released the first findings from their experimentation on artificial womb technology using lambs, which seemed to produce positive results, as you're seeing here in the image. And already then they started the process of filing for FDA approval, and that meeting of the FDA happened just 2 months ago. I guess in Jewish time, 2 months ago feels like some millennia ago. Somehow there was a September, there was an FDA meeting to figure out what the research ethics threshold should be and so on, in order to allow this project this to move forward towards clinical experimentation with humans. So the idea, to be clear, there's been a handful of teams that have been working on forms of artificial womb technology across the globe. The leading team is the one at this point, the one at CHOP in Philadelphia. Their technology is called Extend. There's also another one in Australia called Eve. I believe there's a team in Japan that's working on one. But again, still early stages. At this point, CHOP has had success in having lambs develop in their artificial wombs over the course of about 4 weeks of gestation, which compared to humans would come out to about 8 weeks worth of gestation. So there's it's quite promising the data that they've been able to produce, suggesting that their system for an artificial womb would be a viable option for the development of human embryos into fetuses, into infants. So there's a lot that's exciting about the possible next directions. Now, again, to be clear, what they're talking about now is not being able to take, the sperm and the egg and put them in the machine. They come out a baby on the other end. What we're talking about is you have a fetus that develops and goes through the first phases of fetal development inside a natural environment, whether that's the lamb environment or in our case, the human environment, which is only then subsequently moved into the artificial womb for subsequent development. That's what's being discussed right now. Why does this matter? Why would you do that? Why would there be a scenario where you would want to start the development of the fetus inside a human womb and then move it into the artificial womb? This is primarily for cases of preemies, right? And when a child is, I'm sorry, when a baby is born, extremely early, there can be cases where their bodies are not yet, suited to, do all the things that human bodies are meant to do. Now, these days, generally speaking, if a baby has made it to at least the what's called the point of viability, that's been an important term, viability, estimated somewhere between 23 weeks, 24 weeks, somewhere around there, or maybe even 26 weeks, somewhere around that mark, that sort of a little bit more than midway mark of fetal development, then generally speaking, we said there's the possibility that that baby can then be put into an incubator. Sometimes go through surgery and can make it through. But prior to that point, generally speaking, a fetus won't be able to survive because the lungs, the issues are more complicated than, if there were a specialist here, you'd push me on the details, but at least to boil it down for those of us who are, not in the field of fetal, technology. The lungs of the fetus, generally speaking, are not sufficiently developed until around the 23, 24 week mark in order to do independent breathing. And therefore, if you were to take out an infant from the womb before that point, they wouldn't be, even if you put them on a ventilator, they wouldn't have the lungs with which to breathe, and they wouldn't be able to survive. Now, what the artificial womb offers, something different from what an incubator offers. An incubator is simply an environment in which you could take a fetus, which is technically has the necessary parts, right? The organs in order to survive. They just need to develop further and grow and so on. And they just need to be kept into a safe, clean, environment where they can be monitored, right? That's what an incubator is. The artificial womb is meant to actually mimic the environment of the womb. Now, significantly, one part of this story is that fetuses don't breathe through their lungs. The way that they get oxygen and nutrients and so on is through the umbilical cord, through the and if I'm not mistaken, also through the amniotic fluid. And so what you would need in order to mimic the art the a womb is not to have a what happens for babies in incubators who get put onto a ventilator to help them breathe, right, through their lungs, but you have to find a way to mimic the experience of being in amniotic fluid. And to have access to from the umbilical cord into the baby's system in order to allow for oxygen, nutrients, and so on to be processed through. So that's what the artificial womb could do. Now, again, why this matters is there can be cases, and this happens, where you have really, really early preemies. A baby who's at the point of, let's say 19 weeks, 20 weeks of development, but is not able to, either is not able to survive in utero, or for some reason there's an extremely early onset delivery. And then the question becomes, what do we do with this baby? Now, it may be the case that if we were able to place those fetuses into an artificial womb, they'll be able to continue development as though they were in a natural womb, such they can continue their development and they can survive. Because as things stand today, if you are before that point of what's called viability, if you're before that point where you have the lungs with which to breathe, the presumption that the baby has no way to survive. There's nothing that has been done for such a fetus. And the truth is, even for fetuses who have passed that threshold, still the rates of survival for preemies, though it significantly higher than they ever were, in the pre-modern era, even a number of decades ago, they still are not the highest. Our premise is where we have the highest rates of infant mortality, in the clinical setting. And, it may be that even fetuses that were past the point of viability would still benefit more from being placed into artificial womb technology than simply being delivered and put into an incubator. So that's the value of artificial wombs. Again, it's not the sci-fi thing where we're going to start making babies and machines. We're talking about fetuses that are developed naturally. In a natural human womb, but at some point get moved into an artificial. Which means the set of questions we have to ask is not the crazy set of questions of what would happen if you could have give birth without a human parent or a human womb, a human gestational environment, but a different kind of set of questions regarding what it would mean to use this technology. Now, this point that we said about maybe about viability is going to be an important one. Just referencing a sort of a standard in the field, Black's Law Dictionary, the definition of viability. For purposes of abortion regulation, viability is reached when, in the judgment of the attending physician on the particular facts of the case before her, there is a reasonable likelihood of the fetus's sustained survival outside the womb with or without artificial support. Okay, so, when we're talking about questions around abortion, about the possibility of terminating the life of a fetus, as in many jurisdictions, things are a little bit different in the U.S. now due to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, but it certainly was the case in the U.S. and it still is in some states. If I'm not mistaken, this is the case in Canadian law as well. There's significant difference between abortion prior to the point of viability and abortion following the point of viability. And generally speaking, in jurisdictions which allow for abortion is only permitted up to the point of viability. Again, in many jurisdictions, there could be extenuating circumstances where abortion would be legal even past the point of viability. But generally speaking, in many countries, at least in Western-minded countries, in Europe as well, generally speaking, abortion is allowed only up to the point of viability. Now, it's a little bit hard to determine exactly where that is, right? And to the point where Black's defines the term as being determined by the physician in the case, looking at the particular facts of the case. We can't just like put a number like 23 weeks and know for sure. But the point is, the threshold of viability is the point at which we presume that the fetus has a reasonable likelihood of being able to live outside of the womb. Significantly, with or without artificial support. And the presumption is that even if a fetus is born and you should immediately go into an incubator and onto a ventilator, that's still considered viable because with the right technological support, that fetus can make it. And there are, plenty of stories of children who were born, had to get that sort of treatment very early on in their lives, and nonetheless grew up to be, full-fledged people, functioning well, healthy, and so on. Now, this point of viability in abortion law in Western countries is an important one, and that's because for those countries that want it to be the case that abortion in some cases is legal up to a certain point, you have to kind of put a line somewhere, right? I think most people have some sort of broad moral intuition that moments before a baby is born, let's say that a fetus is carried to term, we're at 9 months. You made it to week 40. At that point, to say that abortion would be allowed would be odd because moments later, the baby will be out in the world and then it'll be a full-fledged human and it'll have all the rights of humans. And there's no real difference in development between the fetus 15 minutes before it's delivered and 15 minutes after it's delivered. In fact, most fetuses 15 minutes before they are delivered, had they already been delivered now, 15 minutes earlier, they would have been fine. And so it seems odd to think that the determination of when does a fetus take on the status of a full-fledged person, such that abortion would not be allowed under these circumstances, at which point we just call it sort of traditional flat-out murder. It doesn't make sense to have that line be when the fetus is born. And so there's sort of an intuition that there must be a point prior, somewhere earlier on, where the fetus becomes human-y enough that it takes on the status of a person. But the question is, where exactly is that? At what point does it, at the beginning of the process, it's just a handful of cells. That doesn't really feel like a person. At the end, it's a baby. That feels like a person. But at what point can we call it, for sure, a person? To have the kinds of qualities that would say that it's functionally no different than all the humans we see and live with all around us. And for that reason, it's part of why the idea of viability was introduced, where if you're sufficiently developed that with artificial support, you could make it out there, well, then that kind of makes you a person. This is where the problem of artificial wombs arises. Because at the moment, the point of viability is approximately, again, it depends on where exactly you put it, but it's at approximately 23, 25 weeks into fetal development. But with artificial wombs, as that technology develops, it may well be that the point of viability, the point of fetal development at which it is possible to survive outside the womb if you get artificial support, may get clear. We might be able to push it back to 20 weeks, to 18 weeks, 17 weeks. And as that gets earlier and earlier, there are going to be questions about what the implications are for abortion regulation, for how do we think about, does this concept of viability still make sense? In fact, a paper from not so long ago, from a bioethics scholar called into question whether the very notion of viability really works as we see that there are all sorts of emerging technologies, including artificial womb technology, as Romanus mentioned, that sort of push our concept of what it means for a baby to be viable. Now, the reason why this matters to us as people who care about Torah is because viability is not the terminology that we generally see in halachic writing. I quote it from the Pnina Halacha from Eliezer Melamed, still living today, in his piece in Pnina Halacha about terminating pregnancy. And it's interesting the language that he uses here. He writes, once a fetus is viable, that is, that it could survive on its own if it were born. He doesn't mention that when we say survive on its own, what we mean by that is survive on its own, either with or without artificial support. He says, it is almost impossible. That's a funny way of saying that. It is almost impossible to permit abortion, even according to those who take the permissive approach, namely the permissive approach to allowing for abortion altogether. However, says Rav Malamed, if it is clear that the fetus would not live for more than 30 days, even if it were born naturally, then in certain cases, some of those who rule permissively would permit abortion. Okay, so Rav Malamed does something very funny. He says, I have this intuition that this viability thing that everyone's talking about really matters. But he says, at some point, it's not the thing that we're hanging our hats on in halachic writing. And the truth is, I didn't bring the other sources because it would be kind of funny to bring them. But most of the writing about abortion in halacha, the Tzitzit Eliezer and the Shevet HaLevi and the Nishmat Avraham and more names of Hebrew books, if it means anything, most of them don't address this point about viability. Right? We saw in our first shiur that there's some significance, seemingly, to the 40-day mark. There's some suggestion that maybe there's some significance of the 3-month mark, but halachic writing doesn't think about viability, and poskim don't tend to talk about viability, such that Rav Malamed, even when he wants to introduce it, has to admit that Rabbis are not so beholden to the viability standard. This matters because we should anticipate seeing in the coming years a shift in discourse in bioethics and in policy more broadly in the jurisdictions in which we live when the notion of viability comes into question. And we're going to need new language, new thinking for what are the circumstances in which abortion is or is not allowed. And at that point, it might be useful to turn to traditions like our own that have ways of thinking about abortion that don't appeal to the idea of viability. And so that might be a role that like Jewish Torah tradition and wisdom might be able to offer as the conversation, the discourse around abortion changes in the coming years. But in the meantime, let's talk a little bit about how we might think about the official halacha. Not only in terms of the impact it'll have on the discourse of viability more generally, but also we have to ask the question about the fetuses in the artificial womb themselves, which is as follows. Let's presume, for argument's sake, that viability, excuse me, that viability is the standard that we use. So we say that a baby is not considered a fully fledged human until they are viable. But what happens when that child is outside of a womb? And we see them in a giant Ziploc bag, like you saw that lamb not long ago. It's going to be much harder to imagine these questions around, is it a person, is it not, when you can see it before your very eyes, even though it hasn't reached viability. It hasn't reached the point where we would be inclined to think of it as full-fledged human. And so the question is, what language do we have to think about at what point a fetus becomes something more than just, some cells or a little creature inside a womb. So the first place that I want to look is actually in the rules of the Erev Halacha of Mamunot. It's important to talk about Mamunot because it though in though subsequently we're going to talk about some of the halacha literature about abortion per se, abortion might not be the right area of halacha to look at for thinking about the implications of the artificial womb. And that's because it might be the case that questions around personhood don't depend on, or sorry, the questions of abortion, I'm sorry, might not hinge on questions of personhood, because it might be that it's forbidden to kill those things not only that are humans, but that stand to be humans in the future. Allow me to explain. It might be the case that we could conclude that maybe before the point of viability, it's not yet a person, a fully fledged person. But it could still be wrong to kill a creature before that is set to become a person. And so it's valuable to think about what other areas of halakha we have to work with. And so today, Mamonot, right, the area of halakha that deals with financial law, right, or economic law, has a different kind of set of questions about having legal standing as a person, right? So what is discussed in halakha is, can you be the owner of property? As a fetus, right? At what point does a fetus become capable of owning property? And we can imagine that being a fitting analog for questions of does a fetus have legal standing in other cases? Does it have legal rights? Does it have citizenship? And so on. So there's an extensive sugya in Masechta Baba Batra, discussing the question of whether an ubar, whether a fetus, has the capacity to own things. Is it possible to transfer property to a fetus? Meaning a fetus has no way of actively buying things, but maybe we can give things, we can gift things to a fetus. So I didn't, the Gemara is kind of long. I wanted to give us a summary to work with, and the Rambam gives his take of the Gemara. And he writes as follows. Kishen she'in adam makne davar shelo ba'al ha'olam. So the same as one may not transfer an object, right, from herself to someone else, which is not yet in the world. This is an important category in halakha. Devar shelo ba'al ha'olam, right? Things which are not yet in the world, right? So, for example, say that I attempt to sell you the fruits that I plan to grow next year in my field, or the year after. Those fruits don't exist, so I have no way of selling that to you, right? Good question. What the implications are for how I think about stock options and the possibility of, further development of, or the future value of, current assets. But regardless, in terms of the framing of the halakhic literature, There's a general rule, you cannot sell a Devar Shelo Bala'olam. We'll see if there are exceptions to this, but broadly speaking, you cannot sell a Devar Shelo Bala'olam. A thing which does not exist cannot be gifted to someone else. So Rama says, the same as one cannot gift a thing, cannot transfer a thing which is not yet in the world. Kach, continuing at the end of the first line of the Rambam. Kach in Adam makne limni shelo bala'olam. One cannot transfer an object to one who is not yet in the world. Right, so the real paradigmatic case of a person who is not yet in the world is not a fetus, but a not yet fetus, meaning an as of yet unborn person. Right, so let's say someone has, I don't know, let's say someone is not even married, right, and they want to transfer property to their first child. They say, I'm hereby gifting this goblet to my first child. That first child really doesn't exist. Like, you've done nothing to make that person exist. That's what we'd call in philosophical literature a future person. So you cannot give things to a future person. But as the Rambam clarifies, I'm continuing after those bolded words, Vafilu ubar, and also a fetus. Harehu kemishelo bala'olam. Right, so a fetus is also considered one who is not yet in the world. And therefore, one cannot transfer objects to an ubar, to a fetus. Now, in full disclosure, the Gemara does discuss that there is one opinion of the Gemara that says that if you formulate the gift in a particular way, if you say that you're gifting the object to the fetus with the sale only coming into effect once the fetus is born, and then when the fetus is born, you still own the object, then maybe the fetus can come to own the object when it is born. Okay, that's a pretty niche case, but still, broadly speaking, it seems to be the conclusion of the Gemara that a fetus cannot be the owner of property because they are not yet in the world. It is such a person is Misha Lo Bala Ola. Now, there is an opinion of the Gemara which is debated. As it so happens, the Rambam adopts this opinion, though it's not universally agreed upon amongst the Rishonim, amongst the medieval commentators. He continues. I mean the middle of that last long line 3 in the Rambam. Vim haya bino, ho'il v'da'ato shel adam k'rova etzel bino kana. If we're talking about one's own child, right? Can you, if you want to bestow some sort of gift to your own child, utero, then because one's mind is close, k'rova, to one's own child, right? You sort of really have your own kid in mind, kana. The transfer does take effect. The Rambam has this interesting view, which is that it is possible to bestow gifts to one's own child in utero, because you have a deeper sort of connection, meaning a deeper sense of their existence than, say, other people. Interestingly, we didn't address here, I didn't bring the sources, but there's machlokes in the Ritva and the Etor, also medieval writers, whether this principle around that there's in this special case, right, where you are allowed to transfer to an ubar, to a fetus, right, as your own child, is that true for a fetus of any age or only after a particular point of development? The Ritva says, even according to this view of Rambam, that it is possible to transfer property to your own unborn fetus, that's only if you're past the 40-day mark, as we mentioned, I think, 2 times ago. There's this notion based on the Gemara, before 40 days, it's Maya Ba'alma in there. It's fluid. You can't even speak of a baby. There's nothing in there. The Etor, though, thinks that you can. Yeah, already, already even from before 4 days, if you're a child in your head, that child is there. So first of all, this notion that we differentiate between the existence or the personhood of the child from the vantage point of the parent of the child versus the vantage point of others is itself quite telling. Right? It might be that the way that we think about various elements of personhood for fetuses might depend on the context and even the particular relationship that we're talking about. That itself, I think, is really valuable insight that the Gemara and the Rambam offer. But regardless, we have this notion that the Ubar is Misha Lo Bala Olam, one who is not yet in the world. And I guess we have to ask ourselves, for how long might we reasonably consider a fetus to be not in the world? Right, and this is where our case comes up. How does it have a fetus who is in the world? if a fetus is born, right, a very early term fetus, but we can see it with our own eyes, right? It's there in this artificial womb. It's there in the giant Ziploc bag. Do we think that that is someone who is bala olam or lo bala olam? That is in the world or not in the world? And what's really, really interesting is a comment made by the Ketzot HaChoshen. I don't know if it's the Ketzos, in yeshivish circles. The Ketzos discusses this question of the legal standing of the ubar, the fetus. But he puts it in conversation with,
Hello.
hello? Someone weighing in?
I am not interested in whatever you're selling. Goodbye.
Okay, all right, I'm gonna continue.
You need to mute everybody.
I see. Great. All right, I think that's that. Okay, all right. Fantastic. Great. Okay, so sorry, continuing. The Ksus has this interesting comment in discussing the legal standing of the ubar, the fetus. And he explains as follows. There's a question about whether one can sell things or transfer things or give things to a fetus. And there's also discussion in the Gemara about whether I can sell you the fruits of a tree when at this point the fruits don't exist. It's just they're only the buds have shown up on the branch of the tree. The first buds are there, but the fruits are not yet there. And the Gemara there says that you can sell those fruits, but the fetus is not considered to be in the world. Okay, so says the Ksos, wait, let's work this out. Fruits, which the buds of which are visible, but the fruit is not yet there, we say it's enough in the world that you can sell it. But a fetus, which is kind of in the world, like you can see there's a fetus in the womb, like you know it's there, that's not considered in the world. So it says, what's the difference between the fruit that's just starting to bud and the fetus that's already started to develop inside the womb? And Ksos writes as follows, that which the Talmud compares the fetus to the budding fruits. Kevan al kopanim. Right, so he explains that when regarding the fruits, the buds of the fruit, in theory, you could sell, and therefore, by extension, you can sell the fruits. But here's the money line. Ubar afilu ma mishum. So that's the Choshen, and ubar is different from these like budding fruits because the ubar, the fetus, is not at all visible. It's mechasya, it's covered. Meaning, according to the Ketzot HaChoshen, what it means to be in the world or not in the world is, are you visible or not visible? Can we see you or can we not see you? And if that's our vantage point, then that might push us towards saying that once the fetus has come out and once it's in the artificial womb, we should consider that person to be here, be in the world. Because the determining factor that we care about in terms of legal standing or personhood is, do we see or do we not? Meaning, once you can see the fetus before you can't deny that it's there, and you can't deny the rights of personhood. So that's one possible way of reading this sugya based on Hilchot Mechira, based on the Ketzot HaChoshen, that visibility should be a determining factor in considering do we think of a fetus in an artificial womb, right? In early stage of development, but we can see it before our eyes. Once we can see it, we have to grant it personhood. On the flip side, there's another way that rabbinic literature talks about the coming into the world of fetuses, not the term mish not the term of Misha bala olam or lo bala olam, are you in the world or not in the world, which the Ketzot HaChoshen reads as, are you visible or invisible? But a different kind of language, emerging from the discussion of the Mishnah in Ahalot, and we'll see this language in Rashi. So the Mishnah Ahalot, is the sort of the locus classicus, is the sort of the starting point of halakhic discussions around abortion. Which reads as follows: Ha'ishashi makshale lev, a woman who is having trouble giving birth. Mechatzchina tavlad v'me'ah motziinu to evarim evarim yipnei shachayah kolvim v'chayeh. Right, that even at the point where the woman is already in the process of childbirth, If we see that she's having difficulty, by which we mean, seemingly, that there's a risk to her life, you kill, namely, you dismember the child to ensure that you can protect the life of the mother. However, Yatsarubo, once the majority of the body of the fetus has emerged, Ein nogin bo she'ein dochin nefesh mipnei nefesh. At that point, you can't kill the fetus in order to save the mother because you can't set aside one person's life for another. Nefesh mipnei nefesh. There's a lot to unpack in this Mishnah. Right? What is it? First of all, why is it the case that the fetus, moments before being born, isn't enough of a person to be saved, and then suddenly becomes a full-fledged person when it's born? And two, how does this principle apply where we say, that when we can't choose one life over the other, then why do we privilege the life of the child over the mother and not the life of the mother over the child? So there's a lot to unpack here in terms of how we might think about abortion, fetuses, triage. There's a lot to unpack here, and it shouldn't surprise that there's a great deal of literature about this Mishnah. But I want to focus on a particular point, which is that Rashi, this is actually Rashi's commentary not on the Mishnah Ohalot, but on Masechet Sanhedrin in the Gemara, which cites the Mishnah. He uses language which emerges from the Gemara itself. He just happens in the course of the Mishnah. Rashi writes, "Dekol zman shelo yatsa la'avir ha'olam," as long as the fetus has not emerged into the air of the world, lav nefeshu, it is not a person, not a living thing. And it can be killed, and then in order to save the mother. But once the head comes out, or majority of the body comes out, then the baby can't be harmed. Says Rashi. At that point, it is born. And we can't choose one life over another. Meaning Rashi, borrowing from the language of the Gemara, and this language appears elsewhere as well, it's not only Rashi's opinion, is that the point at which the significance of the birth is described as the baby having been yatsala avir ha'olam, having emerged into the air of the world. And it's very fitting that we talk about emerging into the air of the world, because as we can see in the text of the Mishnah, the point at which we consider someone a life is the point at which they are a nefesh. Nefesh in Hebrew doesn't really refer to, right? In later medieval philosophical writing, the term nefesh is, or neshama, is sometimes used in reference to the soul, meaning the sort of like the spiritual or ethereal soul, that sort of spiritual stuff that sort of is in us or inhabits us. But in rabbinic writing, deriving from biblical writing, the term nefesh refers to breathing, like neshama refers to breathing, like in modern Hebrew, neshima is to breathe. And so it's somewhat fitting that we say that the point at which you become a nefesh, which is a term that we use to refer to personhood, is the point at which you breathe, and hence only when you are yotzei la'avir ha'olam, when you come out into the air of the world. Not because they were fully aware of the fact that somehow these fetuses were making it through inside the womb, but not breathing. There's no air inside. And so they realize that there's something significant that happens when you are no longer in utero, no longer in the womb, and you join the rest of us in breathing in the air of the world. So here, if we look carefully at the language that's available to us, we have these two different kinds of perspectives on the point at which we consider a fetus to have some sort of legal personhood. One is the point at which the fetus is visible, and which one is bala olam. It's in the world, or at least it's in our world. We perceive it as being in our thought world. Once it can be seen, or do we say that what we care about is the point at which it comes out into the air of the world, the point at which it is breathing, the air of the world. And that would sort of the nafkamina case, in for our purposes, is the artificial womb, is what happens when a baby is born, in the sense that it's no longer in utero. It's visible to our eyes. We see it before us, but it's not breathing like us. It's still in this like sort of special environment where it's still becoming a human. And so we have these different sort of phrases we can use to think about what would be the legal status or the halachic status or the ethical status of this very early stage, preemie or sorry, I was in the early stage fetus. Preemie already implies that it's a premature birth. I won't say that. this very early stage fetus in an artificial womb, do we think of it as alive, as a human, as a person, or not? Now, it might be that the another possible sort of source of guidance on this question is how rabbinic thinkers have thought about incubators. The truth is, as best as I can tell, there has not yet been a comprehensive treatment of halachic thinking regarding artificial wombs. Not a big surprise. It's still relatively new. There's a handful of, you know, sort of small commentary pieces or articles, but I haven't seen a thorough treatment. That's what I'm hoping to do so in the coming months. I think the rabbinic world is waiting for that. So stay tuned. If it gets published, I'll try to let you know. But we do have a lot of thinking about incubators, which can also serve as maybe a good possible framing. So take a look at this tshuva from the Abi Omer, from Ubadi Yosef, where he writes as follows. Hinei lefi divrei harofim, sha'al yedei shenotzim et hatinok be'inkubator, im achom shevo, mashlimin bize kol ma shenasa b'toch harechem mashlamat havlat. So according to what the doctors are telling me, if you take this baby, a preemie, you put it in the incubator, and it's able to continue doing the development that it's supposed to do inside the womb. He says, "Nir eshe kol od lo yatzam ma'incubator la'avir olam chashiku ma'aron arichta." He says, as long as it's in an incubator without ever really making it into the air of the world, it's just considered an extension of the pregnancy. Now, it's kind of remarkable that Rav Ovadia thinks of the incubator as an extension of pregnancy and not yet in the air of the world, considering the fact that the baby does see some air of the world and, in fact, breathes air with a ventilator, but breathes it kind of the way the rest of us do. But he still seems to think that if it is not yet in Avir HaOlam, then we can consider it an extension of the pregnancy. So much so, says Rav Ovadia, that he thinks that in measuring ritual considerations regarding the birth of a child, questions regarding Pidyon HaBen, Brit Milah, or actually what he was facing in this particular Shiva, which is, right, there's a notion that a baby, I'm sorry, that that Shiva is only observed for a person who has lived in the world for 30 days. Good question why exactly that is and whether we really observe that today. But broadly speaking, there's a sense that if a child has not survived 30 days, then Shiva is not observed. And so the question that Rav Ovadia is facing is, at what point do we mark the birth for purposes of Shiva? From the point of human birth or only once the child leaves the incubator? And says Rav Ovadia, being in the incubator is just an extension of the pregnancy. But he goes on to say, in the second paragraph, so he says, I saw in this other book that it was quoted in the name of Rav Eliashiv, at the time Shlita, that the amount of time we should, in order to count 30 days from the birth of a baby in an incubator, we count from the time of natural live birth. Being an incubator isn't an extension of pregnancy. It's merely a means of assistance in the healing of the baby. Right, so Rav Ovadia and Rav Eliashiv kind of ask a very similar question, even before they get to some technical point about halacha, which is, what is our intuition when we look at this thing? Does it look like it's more an extension of pregnancy? Or does it look like the child is born and just being healed or supported? At some point, it's going to be that kind of intuition that's going to dictate how we think about this question. And though at this point, we tend not to think of that way about incubators, it's pretty much agreed upon. We have a baby is being really, really born, even once it gets put into an incubator. We'll have to ask that kind of question regarding artificial wombs. Though, we should keep in mind that the same way that intuitions have shifted regarding incubators, they might shift regarding artificial wombs over the course of time as they're used as well. So, as opposed to some of the previous shurim where we're able to come to some more sort of firm conclusions, the truth of the matter is the artificial womb question is really under development. The technology is still under development. And halakhic writing is really, really in its very earliest stages on this question. But I hope that at least what we've demonstrated is that there is valuable language available to us in halakhic writing to help us think through this question. One final point I want to address is that there's a suggestion made by Dr. Sarah Ronis in the book that she her first book is about demons in the Talmud, and she's actually now working on a second book about fetuses in the Talmud. Two projects which she sees as very much related to each other, because both demons and fetuses have some degree of personhood, but not all the kinds of sort of characteristics of being a person, at least the way that the rabbis imagine it. She writes in an interview that she did, the question that I'm interrogating in my work on the rabbis isn't, is a fetus a person, but rather, what kinds of person is a fetus? Dr. Ronis goes on to explain that if we look at the Gemara, we look at rabbinic writing, the conversation of fetuses is quite different from what we see in a lot of contemporary discourse, which is heavily influenced by Catholic teaching, where in Catholic teaching there's the question of ensoulment. There, at some point, a fetus becomes a full-fledged person. And the truth is, if we look through the Gemara has discussions around the sort of economic standing, or I guess that's not the right term, the legal standing for economic purposes of fetuses, right? Can a fetus buy things, own things? And other questions about whether you're allowed to terminate the life of a fetus. And then there's questions around, at what point is the fetus sort of alive for the purposes of attaining Jewish status, for the purposes of Shiva. And it might be the case that there isn't a single, is the fetus a person or is it not a person, but it might depend on what kind of person we're asking. It might be that there are different elements to personhood, and those different elements might affect at different times. That itself is an insight that which might be useful, especially when we think about artificial wombs. Right? Because, again, returning to where we started, many, many people have intuition, at least in sort of Western cultures. We have an intuition that once a baby is born, it must be a person. But also, there's some sort of significance to the fetus being looking kind of like a human, functioning kind of like a human. And so we care a lot about viability. Viability is a marker of being human. Being born is a marker of being human. And we might soon have a world in which it is possible to be born, but not yet be viable in the traditional sense. And then what happens when we have these different, so we sort of obfuscate our definition of personhood, and it might be the case that the right way to think about it is in line with rabbinic thinking, which is there are different markers of birth, different markers of the onset of personhood, for different elements of what it means to be a person, and that as a sort of general direction might be a useful way of thinking as we navigate these questions of what it means to have artificial womb technology available in the not-so-distant future. I'm about to go through the chat. I'll see what we have here, and then take questions from the floor. But just a reminder about our upcoming topics. Next Monday, Bezrat Hashem, we're talking about whether it is permissible to be a surrogate, an emerging question, particularly in Israel. Right? How do you think through that question? What the familial implications be, and so on? Then we'll talk about who bears the cost of fertility treatment, especially cryopreservation, and finally questions around new type of genetic testing. A lot of interesting, exciting stuff ahead, which I'm looking forward to discussing together. I'll stop the share. Let me start by going through the chat, and then happy to take questions from those of you who are with us in person. So here we are in the chat. Certainly want to make sure siblings don't marry each other. Okay, I think we addressed that one. Opposition to artificial wombs and the sort of full artificial womb technology. I'm with you. It's complicated. Oh, amazing. Thank you to Susanna Levin, who writes here, there are more important things to waste money on than artificial womb technology. This was actually raised at the FDA meeting by a handful of scholars who said, listen, if we're trying to ask ethical questions about artificial womb technology, at the end of the day, artificial womb technology is going to be useful for a very, very slim minority of fetuses. We're talking about a pure set of preemies that's like, you know, it hasn't made it to week 22, but they're like week 21 and a half, you know? So it could be that in the long run, it will have really significant implications for the treatment of preemies. But it's not so clear that that's the case. And so it is a good question. Is this where we should be spending our research dollars? Or Canadian dollars? All right, go ahead. Loss of uteruses. Yeah, definitely a real factor as we think about the possibility of artificial wombs. Going on, there's a tension between defining a parent as a person who raises a child. I'm sorry, reading from the chat. There's a tension between defining a parent as a person who raises a child or as a parent, a person who's getting results in this child. even the absence of personal or intimate interaction results in the conception. If we're genetic medical issues in the, oh, I see. That's in terms of the, he's sure before about, knowing your genetic siblings. Yeah, correct. What is it? At some point, these questions around genetic, relationships bring to the fore questions of what is our account of, parenthood altogether. Okay. Let's find someone else. Futures in the green market. Okay, thank you. Does ultrasound, ask Susanna, does ultrasound change the concept of visibility? I see, or sonograms, yeah. My, actually, a few people asked about ultrasounds, so I'm sorry I'm not addressing it before. I don't think so. You might have expected that to happen, but, you know, I'll reference an analog in halakha, though we could also just speak to our own sort of human experience, but there's an analog in the, when one sees a friend after 30 days of not seeing them, traditionally you're meant to say the Berachah Shehechiyan. Not everybody observes this. The Mishnah Lachot says the reason why people don't do this is because, if you start saying Shehechiyanu when you see your friends, then if you see someone and you don't say Shehechiyanu, then you're basically saying that you're just not such close friends, that you're not excited to see them. It would just be awkward. So he says, just don't bother with this thing. But, at least on the books, there's a notion of saying Shehechiyanu. So you have not seen a friend in 30 days. And, a number of posts, Ravadi Yosef has a tshuva where he's asked, what if you've seen them, video chat, phone, whatever? He says that there's something different when you see a person with your own eyes. There's something exciting about being with that person, that makes it a little bit different. My hunch is that it's the same thing here. The ultrasound gives you a visualization of the infant, or sorry, of the fetus. But I think that it still doesn't have the same sense of like, the baby is here, as it would have if the baby were to come out of the body of the mother and be right, you could see with your own eyes in a plastic bag. Again, a very special plastic bag, you know, in the artificial womb, which is, so my hunch is that it should be different than ultrasound. But it's important for us to keep in mind that our experience of technologies changes with time, right? I suspect that when ultrasound technology first became available, people were like, wow, there it is, the baby. And now we kind of say like, oh, it's a nice picture of the baby, but it's not the real thing. How we experience technology changes with time. And we should be mindful of that. You know, just a related sort of analog that I was teaching earlier today. In the 50s, there was a tshuva also by the Mishnah Lachot about whether you can do Bikur Cholim over the phone. Does it count as visiting the sick if you call them on the phone? And he says, no, it's not like you're really there. He says, but this is some cool sci-fi. He says, right in the 1950s, if they were ever to figure out how to make two TV screens where like you can see the other person on the screen, well, then it would be like you're actually there. So that would count. Now, first of all, just cool that he thought of that, but it's interesting that I think you and I, having spent way more time on Zoom than any of us could have ever imagined just a couple of years ago, we all know that it's not really the same thing as being there in person. And so again, it's a good reminder that when we think about technologies, it's good for us to think in advance of how we ought to think about the impact of technologies on our lives and halakha and ethics and culture, but some of them we're only going to figure out once we understand how it is that we experience technologies culturally. Okay, I think that's everything. Susanna just had a point about Roshover Rabo. If there's a technicality in the Gemara about, it might be a major issue, whether the term is Rosho or Rabo, I'll get too far into that for now. With the remaining 30 seconds or so that we can run a little bit over. Are there any final questions, comments from people who are here? I'd love to hear. I'll start with Asher before Susanna.
This is curious in a different direction, but I wanted to pick your brain. You mentioned the association of the language of Nefesh Chaya with Neshama. So that the rabbis get from the Pasuk, which says, Vayipachba apol nishmat chayim vayehi ha'adam lenefesh chaya, which makes a great deal of sense that the rabbis should learn that association. However, the word nefesh chaya first appears earlier on the fifth day of creation, when it is associated with the creation of the Taninim, Ofot, and all the creepy crawlies in the water, not on the land, in the water. And that is associated with the creation of animal life as opposed to vegetable life. And I wondered whether there's any knowledge or any comments, or you have any feeling about the difference. What Nefesh Chaya really means. The language of Nefesh Chaya, you took the approach of the rabbinical approach of breathing, right?
Yeah.
That there's very little evidence that it doesn't seem to fit with the pasuk on the first time the words together appear in the pasuk on fifth day of creation.
Yeah, animals breathe too. It's one of those things that we share with animals that we don't share with vegetables. Now, it's maybe animals also have a nervous system like we do, but I don't think that the fact that Nefesh Chaya is used in reference to animals rules out the possibility that the term Nefesh refers to breathing, as much as what is interesting in the story, in the creation story, is that with the advent of the existence of animals, there are now breathing things, breathing being associated with living, and all, even just in a technical sense, right, God, you know, Shavat Vayinafash, we're told of God, that God caught God's breath. There's like a few places in Tanakh where Nefesh is associated with breathing, such that I'm inclined to think that Nefesh Chaya does in fact refer to breathing. But even so, we have to always ask ourselves, and this is tricky, when do the rabbis use terms the way that the Bible means them, and when do they use terms in different ways? Meaning, is it possible that the rabbis use the term Nefesh with a particular rabbinic meaning, which they know is different, or don't know is different, from the biblical meaning? And so there's a lot to unpack, but I think the available evidence, you know, in the traditional biblical dictionaries and so on, is that Nefesh is associated with breathing. Again, there's a lot to unpack of what is our concept of soul and life, but I think Nefesh is associated with breathing, but certainly more to explore there. Yeah, Susanna, and then we'll call it a day.
Comment on, somebody mentioned in the chat the discussion of genetic versus social parenthood. In other words, somebody who's brought the children up. There is a book called, it's about identical twins who found out that they were, you know, who were adopted and found each other as adults. And they wrote this memoir, Identical Strangers. It's a wonderful book. In it, at least one of them talks about my biological mother and my real mother.
Mm.
So, I mean, and she says this more than once. So it's, you know, she found out who her biological mother was, who I think was deceased at that point. But her real mother was the mother who brought her up.
For sure. We know they're at some point, there are also the questions that we have to ask about, you know, which set of people does a person consider their parents? And maybe it's even more than one person, more than one set of people. You know, you could say it like there's, you know, depending on what the family sort of setup that you have. I was reading some literature from South America where people, you know, it's more common that people know who is a surrogate that carried a pregnancy for you, and you're just kind of in touch with them, and it's like another sort of mother figure in life. So how this plays out sociologically can take a lot of sort of directions. And in terms of social parenthood, the truth is there are still a lot of questions we have to ask about adoption. If one thinks that the parent position is reserved for the biological parents, again, however we end up defining that, the question is what halachic significance is there when someone is adopted formally, let alone questions around foster care. And I even debated whether that should be one of our topics. It's not really a new topic, but there's been a growth in writing about it in recent years as observing adoption rate have increased slowly, but getting there. So I might even consider whether it's worth setting apart a different setting apart. Oh, sorry, one of the last sessions maybe shifting from polygenic risk scores to adoption. We'll see as we get ahead. But yeah, certainly a lot to unpack about what, once the child is here, so then what does the familial set look like and how does the halakha treat that? So yeah, definitely a lot to unpack there. So thank you. And thank you to everyone for, sorry.
The first American surrogate, if I'm not mistaken, was a couple that had, I think it was a friend of theirs or a neighbor who carried, I think it was via artificial insemination. Who had at least one child for this couple, and they, you know, like they were sort of like, you know, family, all of them.
Our concept of family is certainly being shaken up as we make our way further and further into the 21st century. And there's a lot, it raises a lot of questions, which any sort of traditional community needs to think about, ours as well. So a lot to piece through there. So thank you everyone for joining us for our learning today. I'm sorry we ran a little bit over the hour, but I'm glad that we had some really meaningful conversation and looking forward to seeing you come next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.